Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Gunslinger, Killer's Choice by A.W. Hart. Narrated by Chris Abernathy. The only thing necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. Edmund Burke. Chapter 1. The Arizona Territory, 1883. A cloud of reddish dust whirled in the distance. The plain was flat enough in this portion for Connor Mack to see the group of four horsemen dragging something along behind them, creating the flurry. Was it an animal? He squinted, trying to make the image clearer, and suddenly it was. Not an animal. A man. His head swiveled toward River Hicks, who rode on the other side of the wagon. Hicks had obviously seen it, too, because his lean face, almost always devoid of emotion or reaction, twitched slightly. "You see that?" Connor asked, trying to elevate his voice over the clip-clopping noise of the team of horses next to him pulling the buckboard. Hicks held up his fist, signaling a halt. Zubal Jefferson's dark hands pulled the reins of the team to a stop. Connor's twin sister, Abby, sat next to the old former slave on the seat of the buckboard, both of them partially shielded from the late afternoon sun by the arch of the canvas cover. "Zubal," Hicks said, "keep the wagon here. You and Abby stay ready until we see what this is up there." The old black man nodded, and he reached down to pull out a rather antiquated Henry repeating rifle out of the leather scabbard next to the brake. Abby turned around and pulled out another rifle, this one a newer Winchester 1873 model, from the area behind her, and laid the weapon across her lap. She also patted the top edge of her boot, where she had a Tranter five-shot revolver tucked inside. An exceptionally pretty girl of 16, her cascade of auburn hair was pulled back into a long braid that hung midway down her back. Connor pulled his hat down over the top of his unevenly cut hair and kicked his heels into his horse's flanks. Hicks was already about 20 yards ahead of him, the hooves of his tan stallion stirring up funnels of dust as he pushed the horse to a quick lope over the dry earth. The four men on horseback had stopped, apparently noticing the approach of Hicks and Connor. He wondered exactly what was going on. As they grew closer, he noticed the man being dragged was stretched out on the ground, his body a tattered mess of torn clothes, bloody scrapes, and dirt. The loop of a lariat was around his middle, the line extending upward to the saddle of one of the riders, a large, heavy-set man with an enormous belly. Another of them towed a horse with a saddle but no rider. The faces of the four men grew more hostile the closer Connor and Hicks got. Hicks reined in his mount about 20 feet from the group. Connor edged his mount about 30 feet to the left side of Hicks, just the way his older companion and mentor had taught him. "Never give the man you are facing an easy target," Hicks had stressed as he drilled the basics of gunfighting tactics and survival into his protege, Connor. They'd spent countless hours on the range practicing movements, quick draws, and shooting techniques. Connor now considered himself very proficient, but Hicks was still the master. The youth felt fortunate to having been taught by the best. "What the hell's going on here?" Hicks asked. Although Connor couldn't see it, he knew Hicks's right hand was unimpeded by the reins and was hovering over the Colt 45 Peacemaker in the finely tooled leather holster. He wore an identical gun on the left side with the handle facing outward for a quick cross-draw. Connor had seen him use both guns in rapid succession, and dutifully practiced on his own, trying to emulate his mentor's speed and economy of movement. The man on the ground stirred slightly. A hand fluttered and fell back into the dirt. He was small-boned, slightly built. His head lifted up slightly, his mouth open and gasping for breath. Beneath the sandy film masking the man's features, Connor could see a set of hooded, deep-set eyes beneath a crop of shaggy black hair clumped with dust and patches of matted blood that wound down a thick single braid. This struck Connor as strange until he put it all together. The eyes, the black hair, the pigtail. A Chinaman. He'd seen a few of them in their travels, mostly working on the railroads laying track.
"That ain't none of your concern," one of the four horsemen said.
His voice was high and had a nasally ring to it, his words slurring like they'd been tainted with whiskey.
"We're duly authorized officers of the law."
The man's lips pulled back in an antagonistic sneer, displaying wide gaps of missing teeth. Lawmen? This wasn't sounding right to Connor. He scanned the group. They were a seedy, unkempt bunch who wore their guns low and ready. No badges of any kind were visible, and the neck of a glass bottle protruded from the saddlebag of the big, heavy-set man. The large dollop of fat hanging over his belt almost obscured the end of the rope that was wound around the horn of his saddle. The Chinaman on the ground tried to lift himself up, then collapsed.
"If you men are lawmen, where are your badges?" Hicks said. "I don't see none."
"Badges?" the gap-toothed man said. "We don't need no badges."
His tongue protruded and retracted like a cautious snake through the spaces between his remaining teeth as he spat out the words.
"We're special deputies."
"Is that a fact?" Hicks said. "What did this hombre do?"
"I already told you, that's none of your business," the loose-mouthed man said. "Now you best get, before we give you some of the same."
The man on the ground had managed to rise to his knees, and the heavy-set man gave a sharp tug on the rope, flattening the bedraggled figure prostrate once more. A couple of them laughed.
"Hey," Connor said, "there ain't nothing funny about torturing a man when he can't defend himself."
One of the riders turned toward Connor.
"You want to do something about it, boy?"
the heavy-set man said. His tone was truculent. Connor was in his early teens and big for his age, and having fled an abusive family situation with his sister, had little tolerance for bullies and cruelty, and no fear of a fight. He switched the reins of his horse's bridle to his right hand and placed his left on the butt of his 1878 Frontier pistol. It was double-action army with a self-cocking trigger and shot a .44-40 cartridge.
"Go for that gun, and we'll kill you, pup," the loose-mouthed man said. "I told you, we're special deputies out of Woodman, and this damn Chinaman stole a horse."
"That's so," Hicks asked. "Where's the horse?"
A trace of a smile graced his lips, and Connor sensed what was about to come. He tightened his grip on the pistol's handle.
"That it over there?"
"Yep, right here."
One of them held up the reins of the riderless animal.
"Not that it's any of your damn business."
He spat on the ground and called Hicks a filthy name.
"That's a real nasty mouth you got, partner," Hicks said, "especially for a supposed man of the law."
"Never you mind nothing," the loose-mouthed man said. "We got the authority from the Duke himself."
"The Duke," Hicks said.
"Damn right."
"Authority for what?" Hicks asked. "Torture? A lynching?"
"For this."
And with that, the loose-mouthed man's hand dropped toward his sidearm. He'd managed to get it partially out when Hicks shot him in the chest. His lips twisted into a grimace as he continued to bring up his gun. Hicks shot him again, this time in the forehead, and then shot the man next to him. The sudden burst of gunfire made the horses buck and shuffle around. The heavy-set man was twisting in his saddle, pulling out a long-barreled peacemaker and starting to aim it toward Hicks. Connor steadied his horse, leveled his gun, which he already had out, and squeezed the trigger. A round hole appeared in the heavy-set man's cheek, and he tumbled out of the saddle like a boulder rolling down a mountain, his foot still snagged in the stirrup. His horse bolted away, dragging both the heavy-set man and the Chinaman along the ground. Connor turned and leveled his gun at one of the remaining riders, but saw the man hunch over, his gun slipping from his fingers as Hicks's peacemaker shot fire from the barrel again. The fourth and final man extended his gun toward Connor, and Hicks fired once more, striking the man in the throat. He twisted and fell. The wounded rider pulled his horse's bridle and began riding away at a fast gallop. Hicks straightened his arm, aimed, and pulled the trigger. The man jerked and bounced several times in succession, rolling back over his horse's rump before falling off completely, his foot still snagged in the stirrup. The riderless horse the men had been towing had fled in the opposite direction at the sound of the gunfire. Without another word, Connor kicked his horse's flanks and took off after the heavyset man's now riderless horse, tearing across the plain, still dragging the obese fallen rider and the hapless Chinaman. Connor watched the two bodies bouncing and colliding with the mesquite and shrubs along the uneven ground and couldn't help vicariously wincing. The heavyset man's foot in the stirrup and the added weight and friction of his dragged body was making the horse cant to the right and slow down a bit. Connor pushed his own mount harder and came up on the other animal's left side. Reaching over, he snagged the errant reins and a hank of mane and pulled back, slowing the pace of both horses. After a few more seconds, both horses had completely stopped. Hicks rode up alongside, brought his stallion to a stop beside them, and dismounted. He kicked the bloated form of the rider he'd shot, and Connor saw there was no response. The heavyset man was dead. The tall gunfighter then knelt beside the prone form of the Chinaman and slowly rolled him over. Connor saw the Chinaman's chest heave with each breath. "He's alive?" Connor asked. "Just barely," Hicks said. He pulled his knife out of its sheath, cut the line around the other man's chest. He then lifted him up and laid him belly down across the saddle of the riderless horse. "Guess he'll be stealing another man's horse again," Hicks said, allowing a bit of mirth to enter his tone. "Of course, I don't think Fatso down there is going to complain too much." "Want to tie a line around that tub of lard and drag him back?" Connor asked. Hicks shook his head. "No need to waste the rope. His boots still good and twisted in the stirrup." Connor reached over and adjusted the bridle to allow him to grasp the horse's reins more securely. "Let's get this one over to the wagon," Hicks said. "How bad does he look?" "Bad. Think he'll live?" "We'll see, but I'd hate to think we wasted all them shells for nothing." Connor scanned the plain for the other riderless horse the four men had been towing, but saw only a distant speck on the horizon. "Want me to go try to find that horse that run off?" he asked. Hicks remounted his stallion, glanced in the distance, and then shook his head. "Looks like he's headed in the same direction we're going. Either we'll pick him up on the way into town, or he'll find the way by himself." He steered his horse back toward the wagon. "Let's see what we can do for this fellow." Connor began following Hicks, towing the horse with the unconscious rider behind him. The heavyset man's body made a sharp rustling sound as it was dragged over the harsh terrain of desert shrubs and sandy ripples. The large corpse was causing the horse to assume an unorthodox gait, and Connor had to constantly correct its course. The Chinaman began to moan. "Damn, he's busted up. Think he's got a chance?" Hicks glanced down at the figure still draped over the saddle. "Probably not." He smiled wryly. "I'd say maybe he's got what they call a Chinaman's chance." When they got back to the wagon, Zubal and Abby were already waiting to help take the battered Chinaman off the horse. Hicks watched them from his saddle as he was ejecting the spent shell casings from his peacemaker, one by one, and replacing them with live ammo. He told Connor to give them a hand, and then bring the heavyset man's horse back to the shootout scene. "Yes, sir," Connor said. Hicks smirked, holstered his gun, and steered his horse away. Connor swung out of the saddle and rushed over, only to find Zubal was already cradling the Chinaman. Working together, they gently laid him onto a blanket that Zubal had spread on the ground. Abby gathered some kindling to start a fire and heat some water. After securing the reins on the trail leash behind the wagon and loosening the saddle cinch on the animal, Connor strode over to his own horse and swung up into the saddle once more. He did it in one smooth motion and was pleased with the effort.
He glanced down at his sister, who was wiping the dirt off the Chinaman's face and neck. He appeared to be terribly battered, and Connor had doubts if the man would survive. But he knew if anyone could nurse him back to health, it would be Abby. She'd had a knack for nursing the animals at the farm since she was a little girl. Now she was developing into a beautiful young woman, but she had lost none of her almost magical healing powers. But he also knew she could go the other way as drawing a breath. The conundrum of his sister still mystified him. Sometimes she could be so gentle and caring, and other times she could be disconnected. He'd seen her shoot a man before and express no more remorse about it than if she'd stepped on a bug. With him, it was a different story. Each time he'd had to take a life, it weighed on him deep inside, like a millstone he had to carry. As Connor arrived at the shootout scene, he saw Hicks securing the other three horses that had remained by their fallen riders despite the gunplay. Hicks then went to each of the three bodies and began checking them. The fight had come about suddenly and had been brutal and quick. The smell of death hung in the air. It was a smell that Connor knew all too well, even at this point in his young life. He and Abby had been with River Hicks for a good spell now, and the relationship had grown between the three of them. Hicks had shown up at the Mack farm some time ago, bedraggled and requesting water for him and his horse. Connor had been transfixed. Tall, rawhide tough, and wearing a pair of six guns in two fancy leather-tooled holsters, this rough-hewn gunslinger of a man was the embodiment of Dangerous Dan, the hero the youth had read about in an old dog-eared copy of a dime novel he'd found behind an old haberdashery shop. Connor had obliged the man, much to the chagrin of his father, Jonas Mack, and his three sons. Jonas Mack's obvious distrust and fear of the gunslinger was evident, as it also was in the faces of Connor's three obstreperous brethren. His brothers had never accepted Connor and Abby as siblings, perhaps suspecting that the twins hadn't really been sired by Jonas. There was the constant mistreatment and bullying of Connor, and the more disturbing, pestering, and lascivious glances toward Abby that made both she and Connor intent on getting out of there at the first opportunity. The opportunity to leave, augmented by the beating Connor was receiving from his father, was quickly afforded by River Hicks. The three of them had ridden out that day, never to look back at the pitiful excuse for Ken that Jonas and his three contentious sons provided. Their relationship with Hicks was further annealed by a brutal confrontation with a group of bounty hunters and several other life-changing incidents after that. Through it all, they'd learned to depend upon one another and came to the realization that they were a family, not one based on progeny, but upon choice. Connor halted his horse and dismounted. Hicks was going through the pockets of the loose-mouthed dead man. He stood and shook his head. "No sign that any of them were lawmen," he said. "Not that there was much doubt about that." Connor nodded. Hicks pointed at the pile of handguns. "Unload these and stick them in your saddlebag." Connor squatted next to the weapons, picked one up, and thumbed open the loading gate. "We gonna bury him?" he asked, rotating the cylinder and pressing back the ejector rod for each round. The cartridges popped out into his palm one by one. Hicks took off his hat and smoothed back his long, dark hair so it fell along the backside of his collar. "We'll let the undertaker and woodman take care of that," he said. "I got a hunch we'd better take them into town and explain what happened." Connor picked up the next gun. It was an old Colt Dragoon percussion revolver, and he wasn't sure how to break it open. Hicks reached down and grabbed it, pulling out the locking pin rod and removing the heavy, bullet-laden cylinder. "No need to unload this one," he said. "Just stick both pieces in the saddlebag." Connor complied and continued unloading the other weapons. "Why ain't we burying them?" Hicks glanced at him, as if he wasn't accustomed to explaining himself. Nonetheless, he answered, "If you remember correctly, we still got business in this town of Woodman, and I got a hunch it's probably as crooked as a dog's hind leg. It'd be best to sound things out a little bit, find out what we're riding into. Plus, if we show up with these bodies with their valuables intact,
Nobody can say we dry-gulched the lot of them. If that empty horse makes its way to town before we do, they just might send a posse to investigate, and we'd be at a distinct disadvantage.
Makes sense to me, Connor said.
He knew enough to trust Hicks's judgment in such matters, and his gun hand. Hicks dragged the farthest body over to the horses, picked the dead man up, and slung him over the saddle. Connor did the same with the second one, and then placed the third one onto his horse as well. It took both of them to undo the heavy-set man's foot from the stirrup before they could try to hoist him up onto the final unoccupied horse. Hicks grabbed the dead man's arms, and Connor took the feet. The foot that had been tangled in the stirrup felt loosed in the dead man's boot, like it had separated from his leg. Connor shifted his grip to the calf, and in doing so, pulled up the pant leg. The heavy-set man already smelled bad, but the odor suddenly intensified, and it was immediately apparent that his bowels had voided. Connor, who was on the receiving end, released the legs and jumped back to avoid any unpleasant contact. The big dead body flopped down into the dirt with a thud.
"Lose your grip?" Hicks asked. "Not hardly. He crapped himself."
"So I noticed." Hicks blew out a slow breath and grabbed the end of the rope tied to the saddle horn. "Here, tie this under his arms and we'll pull him over the saddle."
"Guess it's his turn to get roped," Connor said, kneeling to loop the strands around the dead man's chest.
The animal whinnied in protest, and Hicks patted its neck.
"Looks like he don't like the smell any more than we do."
After three unsuccessful tries of trying to keep the horse steady and pull the body up, they finally wrapped the line around the horn on Connor's saddle and used his horse to pull the large corpse up and across.
"Tie his hands and feet together," Hicks said. "I don't want to have to do this again if he falls off."
"Maybe we should have just dragged him into town," Connor said with a grin. Hicks shook his head.
"Two wrongs don't make a right. Besides, we don't want to give the appearance of any animosity between us and the recently departed."
"But we killed them, didn't we?"
"We didn't have much choice about that. Come on."
They used one of their ropes to tie the four horses together on a long lead line and rode back to the wagon. Abby had cleaned most of the filth off of the unconscious man's face. His head was cradled in her lap. Zubal was dipping a rag on a stick into the pot over the fire. Connor could feel the sweat pouring down his own face and neck from all the exertion and wished he had a rag to clean himself. "But it ain't Saturday night yet," he thought with the trace of mirth. In reality, it had been about four Saturday nights in a row since he'd been able to get in a good washing.
"How's the Chinaman doing?" Hicks asked.
Abby looked up at him.
"He ain't come to yet. He's pretty bruised up, but he's still breathing. Zubal says he doesn't have any broken bones."
Hicks steered his horse away from them.
"We'll be back," he said. "We got to go into the town and talk to the law."
"Is that wise?" Abby called out. "It'll be all right, sis," Connor said. "River knows what's best."
"Mr. Hicks is right, Miss Abby," Zubal said, pulling the rag out of the bubbling water and wringing it out with his heavily calloused hands. "Don't you worry none." Abby frowned and gazed up at her brother.
"Be careful," she said.
Connor clicked his tongue and winked before turning his horse to lead the other animals with the dead riders to follow Hicks, wondering what awaited them in this town of woodmen. Overland Stage Line outside Willamette, Colorado. Pinkerton agent William Franklin O'Rourke adjusted his reading spectacles on his nose as the stage bounced over what felt like another substantial rut, jarring his derby hat from his head once again. The newspaper he'd been trying to read crumpled between his sweaty fingers. O'Rourke hoped the ink wouldn't run and stain the navy blue suit that he wore. With that in mind, he removed the white handkerchief embroidered with the three red roses along the opposite corners and carefully wiped his hands. He didn't dare wipe them on his pant legs. The suit, which was standard Pinkerton dress, had cost him a month's salary, but he figured it was worth it to having it fit well over his rotund frame. He remembered the creed of the Pinkerton National Detective Agency.
maintain professionalism at all times. But that was hard, inside of this cramped wooden box on wheels, being pulled by a team of cantankerous horses. Originally being from Baltimore, it was hard for O'Rourke to believe that this had been the primary means of transportation in this part of the country for so long. He'd come west from the Chicago office on the Transcontinental Railroad, and knew the Pinkertons regarded the various companies extending the network of tracks as some of their preeminent clients. "Bring on the railroads," he mentally added. "The sooner the better." He felt more sweat running down his face, through his sparse beard, and settling into the starched collar and the ascot that he'd tied into place. O'Rourke used the handkerchief to wipe the sweat away, and noticed one of the other passengers, a small, rather odd-looking boy of perhaps 8 or 9, staring up at him with a pernicious smirk. The little creature sat beside his bovine mother, who wore a blue and white print dress that was pathetically strained at the seams. Concentric circles of dried sweat ringed each of her armpits, and O'Rourke had no doubt that the underarms of his own clothing smelled just as odious. She slumbered now. O'Rourke was unsure how in this extreme discomfort, her breathing punctuated periodically by an errant snore. He certainly hadn't seen very many attractive women on his trek westward, but that wasn't really his concern. Business was business, and he was a Pinkerton. Professionalism preempted any thoughts of carnal pleasures, although he shivered at the thought of likening that to the slumbering creature across from him. The other passenger was what appeared to be a gambler. He'd pulled out a deck of cards as soon as they'd gotten underway and asked O'Rourke if he was interested in a little game of chance. O'Rourke shook his head and then watched in fascination as the man cut the deck with one hand and then began performing some card tricks. The Pinkertons had issued numerous warnings about card sharks and the various confidence men he'd be likely to encounter. He repeated the second tenet of the Pinkerton National Detective Agency code: maintain objectivity. And the third, maintain anonymity, although this one was coming at a high price. The gambler had removed his dark, pinstriped suit jacket, and O'Rourke longed to do the same, but he dare not. The leather shoulder holster he wore contained an 1878 nickel-plated Colt Frontier 44 caliber revolver with a short barrel. It was good for close distances, but not that effective over 15 yards or so. Pinned next to the weapon was his silver badge, inscribed with the block lettering, Pinkerton National Detective Agency. Maintain anonymity, he silently repeated to himself, and completed the litany of rules that had been drilled into him by his superiors. Maintain absolute loyalty to the client. To that end, he began perusing the newspaper again after a quick glance out the rectangular excuse for a window. The land was dry and hard, with periodic clumps of stunted trees and large cactuses towering over everything. Why the Chicago office had found it necessary to send him this far from civilization, he'd never know. Maintain absolute loyalty to the client. The price of this loyalty came high, and ironically, he didn't even know who the client actually was. Anonymity applied to him as well. All O'Rourke had been able to glean from an overheard conversation in the office regarding a series of telegrams led him to believe that the client was some rich son of a bitch up in Oregon, a lumber magnate or something of the sort. And why he wanted the unlikely quarry run to ground was equally perplexing. Two men and a girl. No, make that. One older man, in his mid-30s, another male much younger, perhaps around 15 or 16, and a female of the same age with flaming red hair. They moved as one unit, and were perhaps related, and the older male was purportedly highly efficient with a gun. Two guns, one worn in traditional fashion, laced to his right leg, and the other on his left side, but facing outward, to facilitate a cross-draw. A gunslinger. A wanted man. A murderer. O'Rourke swallowed. He hoped that he wouldn't have to find out how proficient this gunslinger was. It was rumored that he had killed...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?